Today, we're jumping into a really crucial moment in early Christian history, the Council of Chalcedon, 451 AD.
A moment that was meant to bring everyone together, right?
Yeah.
Define Christology, create unity.
Exactly. That was the stated goal. But when you actually read the transcripts, the verbatim records, especially from session 10, well, it gets complicated. You start seeing things, procedural issues, maybe inconsistencies that make you question how it all went down.
Right. And our mission today is really to unpack that. Why did this council, aiming for unity, end up causing this lasting split with the Oriental Orthodox churches?
And we'll focus on one really fascinating case, Bishop Ibas of Edessa. His story sort of encapsulates the whole messy situation.
And it forces us to ask a fundamental question, really. How is truth, or, orthodoxy, actually decided in moments like these? Who gets to make that call?
Yeah.
Because the analysis, it suggests a pretty pragmatic, sometimes contradictory approach to justice, almost like the rules were bent depending on who was involved. A systemic bias, perhaps?
Okay, so let's set the scene a bit. We're in the 5th century. Things are turbulent.
Definitely turbulent. You have these major theological divides, especially around how to understand Christ. Two main schools of thought, really.
And these weren't just like quiet academic debates in a library
Oh,
somewhere.
no. Far from it. These were tied up with intense political rivalries, power plays between the major church centers, all jockeying for influence with the emperor.
Which leads us straight to the Second Council of Ephesus in 449. History hasn't been kind to it, often called the Robber Council.
Yeah, the Latrocinium, heavily influenced by Dioscorus of Alexandria. And it's there that figures like Ibas get condemned.
Right, and crucially condemned in absentia. He wasn't even there.
Exactly. They also suppress Pope Leo's tome, his big statement on Christology. But then, boom, politics shifts.
Emperor Theodosius II dies unexpectedly in 450. Marcion and Pulcheria take the throne.
And they completely reverse course on church policy.
Yeah.
They call a new council.
And they move it specifically to Chalcedon. Why? The records mention wanting tighter control, closer imperial eyes on the proceedings.
Which already hints that maybe the outcomes weren't entirely left to theological debate, shall we say?
It certainly raises questions. So this brings us to session 10 at Chalcedon, the rehabilitation of Ibas.
Remember, he'd been condemned just 2 years earlier at Ephesus II, accused of Nestorianism, criticizing Cyril.
And at Chalcedon, he makes his case very clearly. He says, and I'm quoting roughly here, "I was condemned in my absence. I wasn't present. I couldn't defend
A
myself."
powerful plea.
And then, incredibly, the bishops at Chalcedon declare, and this is almost verbatim from the Acts, "Those who condemned him contrary to the canons acted wrongly. Let the proceedings against an absent person be annulled. This we all say, no one condemns someone in his absence."
Wow. A very strong statement on procedural justice.
You'd think so. They use that exact principle to bring Ibas back into the fold.
But then things get murky again, don't they?
Huh.
With his letter to Mari.
Ah, yes, the letter to Mari the Persian, written way back in 433. It was read out in the session.
And it's, let's say, controversial. It praises Theodore of Mopsuestia, who was later linked strongly with Nestorianism,
Yeah.
and it's pretty critical of Cyril of Alexandria.
You'd think that might cause problems for Ibis's rehabilitation.
Right. But here's the twist. The Roman delegates, the Pope's representatives, they interpreted that very letter as proof that Ibas was innocent. Orthodox, even.
It seems convenient, almost like the decision was already made and they were finding ways to justify it.
It certainly suggests a predetermined outcome, which leads us to the glaring inconsistency, the double standard.
That really highlights how political aims seem to be driving things, and the doctrine itself seems flexible too.
Absolutely. That letter to Marius, the one Chalcedon used to say Ibas was Orthodox.
Yeah.
Fast forward about a century to 553, the Second Council of Constantinople. That same letter gets condemned as part of the three chapters, deemed heretical.
So the same text is proof of orthodoxy in 451 and proof of heresy in 553.
It certainly looks that way. It shows that Chalcedon's judgment on its orthodoxy served an immediate political purpose, rehabilitating Ibas, rather than representing some timeless, fixed truth.
And we haven't even touched on the pressure to create the Chalcedonian definition itself.
Right. The bishops initially didn't even want to write a new definition of faith. They felt the Nicene Creed was enough.
But the emperor insisted. Marcion basically threatened them, didn't he? Said if they didn't produce a definition, he'd move the whole council to Italy, closer to Rome's influence.
Exactly. Direct imperial coercion. And the final definition. It wasn't hammered out in open debate by all the bishops.
No, it was drafted by a select committee behind closed doors. No minutes, no records of their discussions, just poof, here's the definition.
It feels less like a consensus emerging from the church and more like something imposed from the top down,
yeah,
driven by imperial will.
So, wrapping this deep dive up, Chalcedon aimed for unity, aimed for clarity on Christology. But what the records seem to show is, well, selective justice, doctrine that shifted with political need and the heavy hand of the emperor.
Which helps explain why it wasn't universally accepted. For many, especially in places like Egypt and Syria, it felt like an innovation forced upon them, not an authentic expression of faith. Hence the schism that persists even today.
So the takeaway for you listening, when you encounter these big, definitive statements, whether historical declarations of truth or orthodoxy or even contemporary ones,
it's worth asking, how is this conclusion reached? What was the process? Who was involved? Who wasn't? What motivations, besides pure theological reasoning, might have been at play?
Because Chalcedon is a powerful reminder, isn't it? Procedural choices, political pressures, they can fundamentally shape what gets remembered and accepted as fact. Something to think about.